Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, along with Daniel Foster of National Review Online, filling in for Jim Garrity this week. And, Dan, it's been a strange, crazy week. If anyone thought that things would slow down as a result of the election being over, we've got plenty of other things that have made us happy, sad, mad, driven us crazy, and we've got no shortage of those either. Today, this latest story kind of reflects on where Mitt Romney's place will probably be in the party as we get further and further away from the election. But it also harkens back, of course, to his famous or infamous, depending on how you look at them, comments at a fundraiser where he talked about the 47% that his campaign will have a very hard time or an impossible time reaching and getting to support his candidacy. He later walked that back, saying he spoke very inartfully, it was a dumb thing to say, so forth and so on. Well, in his first comments, really, since his concession speech, Mitt Romney, in speaking with supporters, pretty much said that's exactly why he lost. Here's what he had to say.
What the president's campaign did was focus on certain members of his base coalition, give them extraordinary financial gifts from the government, and then work very aggressively to turn them out to vote.
And that may in large part actually be true, but if you're the future of the Republican Party and not the past, as Romney appears to be now, that's not going to help you at all. So folks like Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal say this is not helping at all, and here's why.
And it's certainly not helpful to tell voters that you think their votes were bought. That's certainly not a way to show them that you respect them, you like them. We need to stop talking down to voters. As a Republican Party, we need to fight for 100% of the electorate, not 53%, not 52%, but 100%. We've got to stop trying to divide people into different groups by race, by gender, by class. Instead, we've got to show them that our conservative principles will help them pursue the American dream, enter the middle class, do better.
Now, I would argue that Mitt Romney was simply talking about how the president's campaign was marginalizing and dividing people along racial, gender, and class lines and so forth. But Jindal's right. If you constantly point out what Romney was pointing out, it's not going to broaden the base, so to speak.
Yeah, I like Jindal's enthusiasm. And as you said, that's about the future of the party and trying to win the next time. And I like, you know, and I agree with his message. But I might be the only person in the world who thought that 47% was bad. But what Romney said about these gifts is, if inartful, at least getting at the truth. The problem with 47% is, as we all said at the time, is that there were, there's roughly 47% of the electorate that wasn't going to vote for Romney no matter what. They were in the tank for Obama. Roughly 47% that were dependent on some sort of federal entitlement program, and roughly 47% that didn't pay income taxes. The problem for Romney is that none of them were the same 47%. So it was a really stupid thing to say, and certainly not something that you should say if you want to inspire America or bring America together. But, you know, you're absolutely right. He was talking about the kind of campaign that Obama ran, which is, and he described it pretty accurately. It was a base campaign, and it went to shameless, almost unprecedented lengths to target specific demographic groups and turn them not just on a Romney candidacy, but on Romney as a human being. If the war on women stuff is the most glaring example of that. So I actually didn't have a problem with what Romney said, honestly. And, you know, it might doom him as a spokesman for the party going forward. Not that I thought there was a really great chance of that anyway. But I think he got at some element of the truth.
But Jindal is right. You got to move forward. You got to focus on how the conservative message does apply to everyone. And I think Romney did try that to a large extent, particularly in trying to explain away his 47% comments in the video from earlier in the campaign. But I thought for the most part he did try to explain why those principles were good for everyone. But now it's up to Jindal, Rubio, and whoever else is going to seize the mantle of the Republican Party, Scott Walker perhaps, to really explain why conservative approaches are better, even if you are the one getting assistance from the government. So on to martini number two now, Dan. And we briefly alluded to it yesterday when we talked about the huge spike in jobless claims from last week. And that's the closure of Hostess. Yesterday, the leadership at Hostess said the Bakers Union had until today, meaning yesterday, to come to the table to agree to the terms, or else Hostess is going out of business, they're liquidating, and instead of taking pay cuts, these 18,500 people are all going to be out of work. The Teamsters Union had agreed to those terms earlier in the year. They're not happy with the Bakers Union. Here is Gregory Rayburn. He is the CEO of Hostess, explaining how the union basically tried to call the company's bluff here and really screwed up big time.
It's been very difficult. We reached deals with a number of our unions and our largest union, which was the Teamsters, and they actually supported the deal that we offered. And they've been crossing the picket lines and trying to support the business. But the Bakers Union, I think the leadership of that union made a decision that they're willing to sacrifice these jobs because they don't really want to have these kind of concessions from other companies.
Rayburn there was talking with Savannah Guthrie of NBC's Today Show. The union is saying that this is all the fault of the company, Dan, but if it was all the company's fault, these people would still have jobs.
Yeah, this is kind of a interesting, if unfortunate, example of what's been going on in the broader labor movement the last decade or so. Places like New Jersey, Wisconsin, you saw public sector and private sector unions clash, especially in New Jersey, and you're starting to see unions clash with each other over the best way to handle essentially this really long recession and all of its side effects. And this is an example of that. Look, the labor movement in the United States is remarkably successful over the last century, you know, as a force. The sort of stuff that it came into being to fight, you know, poor workplace conditions, broad unfairness, slave labor, things like that are all gone. And labor protections are enshrined in law. All kinds of laws, all kinds of regulations. Ask somebody at the Cato Institute about OSHA, for example, and you'll get a laundry list of how maybe there's too much worker protection enshrined in regulation, too much overregulation there. And so what you're seeing happening of late is the labor movement kind of falling apart out of its own success. And one of the symptoms of it is leadership whose incentives are at odds with membership. And in this case, you saw it where the leadership decided that they didn't want to take pay cuts for their members at Hostess because of its potential to spill over into other deals that the Bakers Union had with other companies. And the result is 20,000 people out of work.
Well, there has been one little bit of misinformation that Rayburn cleared up, and that's everyone thinks the Twinkie died today. Hostess died today. The Twinkie, whatever else they make, the Ho-Hos, the Wonder Bread, the cupcakes and so forth, they're going to sell those off to the highest bidder, so they will probably still exist in some form or fashion. Whether that actually means jobs in this country or whether they get mass-produced somewhere else, hard to say. But
I'm a ring-ding partisan, but I don't know if I would eat Chinese-produced ring-dings. There's too many horror stories.
Now, on to martini number three now. Dan, you and I and Jim and I have certainly chronicled over the last few years how Senate Democrats always keep forgetting to do something. Well, forgetting to do a lot of things, like even consider House-passed legislation. But the one thing they always seem to keep forgetting how to do is pass a budget. They've just pretty much ignored that whole thing in the past 3 years. 2010, they thought it would hurt them at the polls. Turns out they got clocked anyway. And then the last 2 years, they just figured, well, we didn't do it last year, so why even bother anymore? Well, now Patty Murray of Washington State is looking to be the next chairwoman of the Senate Budget Committee. And it looks like this little trend of not passing a budget might not end anytime soon. Her comment is, I'm committed to working with our committee and our Congress to put a budget in place, but there are a lot of questions in front of us. What happens in the next 2 weeks, 6 weeks, year? Does the White House and the leadership come together on some solution to the budget that we have right now that precludes a budget being written next year? So she's already making excuses for herself, which really ought to make the people who just weathered a fierce election season really confident.
Yeah, a fun thing to do, and I think it's substantially right thing to do for somebody like Rand Paul, who's always good for these awesome symbolic displays of the dysfunction of Washington politics. Somebody should propose, you know, amending the structure of the Senate to disband the Budget Committee on the Republican side, because after all, it's a, you know, throw it into a anti-sequestration bill. You know, save a little money. You can fire all the Budget Committee staffers. You can, rent out the Budget Committee room to private businesses. You know, save a little money, reduce the deficit a little bit, because they're not doing anything of any use in there.
I don't know how they excuse this of themselves. I know in some convoluted way they think they supposedly passed a budget when they agreed to the debt ceiling extension. I'm not quite sure how they come to that conclusion. But anyway, if enough of the American people were paying attention to this, we'd have a different party in control. But sadly, between our own stumbles and people not paying attention, we're stuck with what we've basically had the last 2 years. So, Dan, as always, thanks for being with us. Great job filling in for Jim, and we'll talk to you later.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Daniel Foster of National Review Online in for Jim Garrity. Jim will be back on Monday, as will I. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us on Monday for the next edition of the Three Martini Lunch.